Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned in to Real College Podcast, back with another diverse set of real, locally grown, organic stories from around the cities. We've got heaps of garbage, restorative justice, and an exclusive interview with Deb Demir and Mona D of Drab Majesty. I'm your host, Nathan Fervoy. Stick around. Garbage is full of weird stuff, and if you ever put in the time to go rifling through another person's trash, you can come back with some pretty interesting stories. New reporter Drew went out on the street to hear some of the strange stuff folks have pulled out of the trash.
What's the coolest thing you found on the side of the road or while dumpster diving?
I did find a mattress, and it was like an Ecto mattress, which was memory foam and actually pretty nice. And it was free, and then when I got there, the reason that I found out that it was is because there was a pretty giant pee stain on it. But they had managed to wash it out, so it didn't smell, so I just got like a nice mattress cover, threw that on it, and it's been working out really well.
Actually, the couch that's in my living room, we found on the street. We saw like our neighbors putting it out onto the street, so like we picked it up like immediately after that, and now it's in our living room.
I mean, I don't really go dumpster diving or anything, but like I was walking a dog once and saw an empty bottle of vodka.
Oh, this was a while ago, but it was right after I was looking for a desk for my like home. And I had already bought a desk, but I was driving with my mom and I saw the exact desk that I wanted and I didn't pick it up, but I was very upset about it. And it was like a nice little, like, it was like a very solid wooden desk and I was a little frustrated, but that happened. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can find some really cool stuff just laying out. I don't know why people would throw that away. You can find some cool stuff.
I had a friend who found a flat screen behind Best Buy, like boxed up and everything. Like, that was pretty great.
So I had to find a box spring that worked, but I couldn't find one. So I found a mattress on the side of the road and it was pretty disgusting looking. So I bought Clorox bleach and I sprayed it down on both sides and it worked great. Two mattresses stacked up. It was perfect.
I wasn't involved, but I had some friends go out dumpster diving behind like a bunch of like big box stores. I'm pretty sure it wasn't legal, but you know, they're still like, whatever, we're gonna go for it. And they didn't really find anything too worthwhile, but I kind of regretted, like in the back of my head, I was like, I kind of want to do that, but I don't know. It seemed a little intimidating. Yeah. They went to all the stores that you'd kind of expect, like classic, you know, like Best Buy and like Target and all those. But they actually didn't find anything.
Back at the beginning of the semester, I also did my own bit of dumpster diving. Like the weather, garbage changes with the seasons, especially in the late summer for us students. But where exactly does it all end up? I dug a bit deeper into the trash heap to find out. For those of us whose life paths lead to college, we know well that this period of time is not exactly conducive to stability. It's a time which we devote to inhaling as much knowledge as humanly possible within the span of a few short years, which, to accomplish, takes a certain kind of light-footed living. By this, I mean any devotion or too strong an attachment distracts from the learning and risks holding us back from where we're supposed to be headed after graduation. And so we students tread lightly and forge connections with caution. Not looking for any commitment, we buy cheap or make use of what's around us, and we don't hesitate to let go when something becomes too much of a burden. This is most apparent during the cusp between late August and September, moving season for the neighborhoods around campus, when students leave anything too burdensome to carry with them out on the curb.
It's ripped right here, so that's kind of bad. It says free.
Dressers and drawings and mattresses all are piled outside.
In the recycling.
Even stuff that must have held some significance at some point, like old hobbies and even the occasional love letter.
Definitely
ended relationship. Yeah, definitely a relationship has ended.
Oh my god.
Should I read it?
Yeah.
Dear, I love you so much and I can't let go. I don't think anyone will ever understand, not even me. Even if / when you move away, I won't love anyone else. I was thinking, and I really think it's good we're together. Your wife.
Perhaps no item better represents this sort of disposal by students than the common curb couch. These couches, found all over after moving week, share a lot of hanging out time with their temporary owners, and can come to hold many memories, as well as some other stuff.
My friend found, his chapstick and a jewel when he was moving this out, so.
Yeah, we love this couch. It's a sex-positive couch. We found a thong in it one time. It's got some good stains on it. It had a good run, and we're gonna miss it.
Yeah, we had a couple couches that had been sitting in the garage for the 2 years that we were at this place. Lots of memories in that house, good and bad. And we put them out by the curb while we were moving, and then since our house was in total disarray, we would actually just go and sit on the couches during our breaks, like at the curb. And at one point we ordered a bunch of pizzas and just like sat the pizzas out there by the curb and sat and had dinner in the dark, you know. I feel like it was this like a little bit of this like reflective experience, you know.
But despite the good times they embody, couches are heavy and easier usually to leave behind than schlep along. Once placed out on the curb, some couches might get picked up by other students in search of some non-committal furniture, but others are left until the city comes to clean up. From there, these couches are out of sight and out of mind.
The week goes on, we have more. Monday, there's a little bit of work done over there.
Funny enough, as opposed to the disposable student lifestyle, which generates all these street sofas, hauling them away is one of the most stable and necessary jobs in the city.
We have a lot of people that stick around a long time. We just had a 31-year employee retire this morning, I'll tell you that. So my name is John Melrose. I'm a field foreman with City Minneapolis Solid Waste and Recycling Division.
Cool. All right. Yeah, and where are we headed first this morning?
We'll head over southeast and take a look at some addresses that might have a problem.
I rode along with John back in September to follow the paths of all these couches past the curb to see what kind of lives they go on to live after college.
Late summer, we do our
John's job as a supervisor is to drive around and inspect properties, taking note of large items and leaving a tag where there's an issue with the amount or type of garbage, which might make it difficult for the garbage crew to clear.
You find an orange tag on your garbage cart, read it, and it'll tell you what the problem is, and then if you correct it, everything's good.
Pretty soon, we rolled up on a group of couches.
So here we got some furniture.
You ever see something, then you're like, damn, I wish I could grab this, maybe take it home to somebody or bring it to somebody I know, anything like that?
Yeah, we've seen stuff like that. I was out on a route, and this resident was throwing away. They were Bud Light patio umbrellas, mm-hmm. The big ones you see at a bar. Stuff like that is, it's like, man, that patio umbrella would look great on my patio. And but the policy at the city is we don't bring anything, we don't take anything. So something like that, if you can.
While they might encourage residents to donate their items or bring them to a reuse center, ultimately the job of the garbage man is to dispose of the garbage, no matter what it is.
You know, a lot of it gets thrown away because we can't do anything with it, and that's not, you know, there's no bad intent there. It's just a policy we have to have too. But it's kind of, it'll tug at you a little bit sometimes when you have to throw away toys. Is one thing that we don't like to throw away, but sometimes we have to. It's just, you know, stuff like that. We, you know, we're garbage men and we see a lot of stuff, but it's, you know, we're humans too. We don't. So on on your recycling day, you put all your problem materials and the truck picks it up, this is where it's brought to. So we'll kind of make a lap around the yard here.
The yard is an intermediate stop for any large items that get thrown out. Here, they're sorted out by type into containers of antique televisions, piles of old refrigerators, and, over in one corner of the lot, the recent couch arrivals.
Now we're on the furniture section.
Yeah, can we hop out here?
Yeah. So, like all the move-out furniture, its final destination is here, where we'll take your hide-a-bed couch, take it apart, recover the metal out of it, recycle that, we can pull the mattress out.
Once all recyclable material has been removed, the remainder is treated as any other trash, compacted down.
Would you mind if I get some sound of you crushing it?
What you're about to hear is the end of the line for one curb couch, at least in its couch form.
What's left is wood and fabric and foam and fluff. And that goes in the trash, and that can be easily burned at the Herc plant.
For the leftover bits of couch, the Herc plant is the next stop. A massive incinerator downtown, right next to Target Field.
Those stacks right there, the big, that's where the exhaust comes out of. It's a power plant, and their fuel there is garbage, so it's waste to energy. This plant powers pretty much all of downtown and a lot of the surrounding area, too. They're the bottom ash is what it's called. Everything that falls to the bottom is transported to a landfill facility, but at 80% less the volume.
And so, while some curb couches come to rest as ash in landfills, some pieces continue to live on as recycled metal or the lighting in Target Field or as a number of other less than obvious uses.
I think they're starting to work on other uses for that bottom ash. They're talking about using it in like road surfaces and stuff.
As to why exactly the waste department goes through so much to ensure that garbage finds some use, John had this to say.
The goal is to reduce as much trash as we can. So by diverting your recyclables to recycling, and now we have less garbage weight, the goal is to produce less garbage and recycle more. Eventually go down to, I don't think a zero waste plan, it's going to take a lot to make that happen. Is it possible? Yes. But
for someone like John, who sees so much of our trash after we've put it out of our minds, it's more than just trash. It's things that we've once lived with and loved and that we're now choosing to forget.
Yeah, I think you try to enjoy that stuff as long as you can, but eventually, there's only so much room for finger paintings and googly-eyed pictures, so it's fun to kind of keep that stuff around, too. It's good to, I enjoy history a lot, so I like, studying history, so there's that.
you're kind of seeing a lot of people's history. You're dealing with a lot of people's history, really.
Yeah, if you think about it that way, it's, or ones that your trash is your past. It's stuff you don't want or stuff that, you used and got rid of. And I mean, I never really thought of it that way, but yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, your history typically affects the present. So, use what you need and don't use what you don't need. Simple as that. You don't need to be wasteful, just more stuff that's going to end up in the trash. So
many thanks to Mr. John Melrose for giving me the trash tour of Minneapolis, not once but twice for this story, after some catastrophic technical difficulties. Along the way, John shared countless tips on how to properly set out your garbage for moving time, which I unfortunately couldn't fit into this story. If you have any questions about garbage collection, visit the City of Minneapolis website or give them a call.
I was thinking, but I really think it's good.
the same place, and I think we can help each other out. I know we both have to do it ourselves, but we can support each other as much as possible. I want you to remember that helping people is...
As concern and criticism of the American criminal justice system has grown in recent years, many have called for programs which rehabilitate law offenders rather than continuously cycling them in and out of prison. Restorative justice programs have sprung up to take on this task, but their full implementation requires that cities, like Minneapolis, completely rethink why people commit crime. Producer Ben Hallam has more.
One of the biggest legal stories of recent years has been local prosecutors around the country adopting innovative new policies aimed at reducing America's prison population while also targeting recidivism, or repeat offending, and crime. One of those programs is right here in the Twin Cities. The Ethos Program, a restorative justice program launched by St. Paul City Attorney Lindsay Olson in Wards 1 and 2 this September. The Ethos Program uses healing circles composed of community members to come up with restorative justice plans aimed at holding first-time offenders accountable and reforming their behavior. Here's Lindsay Olson describing the program.
What we do is we're working with a restorative justice practitioner to run circles. So we take in offenders and review their cases for whether they would be appropriate for the program. And then the prosecutor would determine if they would be appropriate for the program based on their history and circumstances. And we would talk with the victim in the case. And if the victim is in concurrence and the offender is willing to go through the program, they would contact the restorative justice practitioner and they would work with them to set up a circle time. The offender has the opportunity within the circle to understand the consequences of their actions, repair harm that they've done, and they also get access to wraparound services that would be directly designed to modify behavior that led to committing the offense.
Olson said that she expects the program to have a higher participation rate than existing diversion programs, while also having a lower recidivism rate than the traditional justice system.
A regular diversion program, historically, it's had around a 50% participation rate. The programs that we went and talked with had about 96% of their participants appearing for the program and 91% to 93% completing, and that's, you know, really high rate. Recidivism rates are around 6% for those who complete the program, and that is an extremely low recidivism rate. Recidivism rates for, you know, traditional prosecution are very, very high, and that's one of the real challenges with the traditional system of justice. Barriers to reentry, they're leading to second and third order consequences that make it harder for them to succeed in life. What we're trying to do is look at different ways of holding people accountable that also allow them to reintegrate, also allow them to rehabilitate, looking at what are the root causes that are causing them to engage in crime.
To find out more about what's behind these restorative justice programs and how they're expected to work, I spoke with Donna Minter, the founder and executive director of the Minnesota Peacebuilding Leadership Institute, a program which advocates for restorative justice in the Twin Cities and around the state. She wanted to distinguish between the drive for justice, which she sees expressed in restorative justice healing circles, and the drive for revenge, which she sees expressed in the traditional justice system.
We believe that all humans have a basic need for justice, cooperation, justice, and fairness. And when that basic human need does not get met, or when somebody has something terrible that happens to them, that interferes with their sense of justice or fairness, it is so easy for people to instead have a drive for revenge. But too often, people get that drive for revenge confused with their human need for justice. And when they do that, they end up becoming an aggressor and then in turn create more victims. And then it just goes on and on and on and on.
Minter said that while restorative justice may be seen by some as overly forgiving to the aggressor or letting criminals off the hook, restorative justice is actually about the victim, about meeting the victim's need for justice and allowing them to heal from whatever was done to them.
Restorative justice is primarily first about empowering victims. People don't need justice or restorative justice or any kind of justice unless there's been something terrible that's happened. And so recognizing that and then being able to say, how can we transform this into nonviolent power? Anytime something terrible happens, it's not uncommon for victims to say, I want to know why you did this. What's the story behind this? I want to know why you did this, and I want to know why you did it to me. To have those kind of questions answered can be incredibly empowering, healing and empowering for a victim to get those answered. And nobody can answer those except the person who did the harm. And again, the retributive justice system has no place for that.
For those who may still be skeptical of restorative justice's role in our justice system, St. Paul City Attorney Lindsay Olson has some pretty simple advice. Go out and get involved in your neighborhood restorative justice organization and see it for yourself.
These are programs that work for people. They work for communities. They heal people. And it seems it's not something that's easily explained without experiencing it. And I think for people that are skeptical about the experience, I challenge them to get involved, to go to the circle, experience the circle, volunteer. If you don't like it, you don't have to continue, but it's a transformative experience, and it's like nothing else. And I think that, you know, that's something that can really turn someone who is a skeptic into a believer.
The Ethos program is currently in a trial phase, but if all goes well, hopefully we can see restorative justice expanding throughout the Twin Cities in the near future. For Real College Podcast, I'm Ben Hallam.
LA-born Drab Majesty has been making music blended between the genres of dark wave and new wave since their 2012 EP, Unarian Dances. Inspired by their fusion of performance art and live music, our music reporter Lizzie Ritchie reached out for an interview during their visit to Minneapolis back in August. We'll get to hear from the more personal side of Drab Majesty and how their alter egos, Deb Demure and Mona D, came to be.
For a lot of people, masks, you know, face paint, costume is a tool for liberation. It can also be a tool to hide. I think in this band's case, it was both. For me, I started the project in 2012, kind of focusing on a void in music and live performance that I saw, which was theatrics.
There's a lot of our personalities that don't kind of leak out in these interviews, and it's a very oft glamorized thing to be on tour, but at the core of it, it is people grinding away at their health, their mental fortitude, and trying to take something out of it other than just money and fame, like to just be better people and better at our jobs and to provide like an amazing experience for the people who really are supporting us.
To see Drab Majesty live is more than going to a concert. You're witnessing the music being performed, and you receive this experience like it's being handed to you on a silver platter. They truly play the role of embodying the music, and that's where the characters they play, Deb Demure and Mona D, come in.
The music also needed a character while looking to give another name and another persona, because I truly don't feel like it comes from me, and I still don't. I don't know anything about writing music. I don't know anything about notes or anything. It's all very intuitive process that I'm still not really fully ready to take credit for.
Using these alter egos or characters as a form of self-expression, they told me about their roots in LA and how that influenced them in the way that they see performance art.
LA in general is filled with a lot of real life characters. And I, growing up there, and I know Mona can attest as well, you can walk around that city and there's some really interesting people with very interesting stories that just, there's a look to the LA character.
With this, Mona and Deb were friends before they started working together. It wasn't until they recognized their overlap with having similar influences and interests creatively did they start collaborating with one another.
I kind of came into it midway through the process of its development, and as we became friends, like, it became very apparent that we both shared a lot of influences. And I think sometime in like late 2016, Andrew played me just an idea. He was very like kind of casual about it in the car, but I could tell it was something that was really special. And he played me this idea, and I thought it was really, really good. And he was like being very humble about it and sort of not showing all of his cards. And he was like, "What do you think about this?" And I was like, "Oh, I think it's amazing." And we kind of started just in that moment, like working on a melody together, and then got really excited about it, and then ended up writing what would become Too Soon to Tell on the demonstration.
As we delved deeper into the conversation, we started talking about the best part of touring and what makes performing so special to them.
Mona and I are deeply into traveling and experiencing other worlds and other states of mind, and other, you know, whether it be traveling in our bedrooms on psychedelics or going to, you know, Bogota or obscure place, just meeting people. It's almost becoming like the best excuse to see the world.
I just think it's a very unique experience. You make friends all over the world, and some of these friends, I can honestly say, are now the closest people to me in my life, and it has shrunk the world and made it just more accessible. I really just hope that we get to go to more and more places and meet all the people who share things in common with us and form this kind of vision of the world that is very human and very kind of like united under the banner of expression and artistic creation.
Even with crazy experiences that are unlike any other.
I really love Moscow and St. Petersburg. The architecture, the people, the crowd, we are greeted with open arms there. Those kind of experiences really make a city for me. The experience we had for sure might be a little different than your typical touristic experience, taking an 11-hour train through the icy lanes through the night on a train that has no ventilation while you're safeguarding your equipment, hoping no one robs you, and everybody on the train is drunk or passed out from being drunk. It's called the sleepy train. Is that what they call it?
As their career has taken them on such a beautiful life journey, their music has started to move more into a realm of new wave and pop music. Their earlier albums, like Completely Careless and The Demonstration, have a bit of a darker sound and energy to them. But as you can see with their latest album, it's taken quite the turn.
You could tell that it is a strong departure. It's a totally different mindset. It's a different color palette. The record cover is purple and blue and gold. And also, this record has more vocal harmonies on it than any recording we've ever done, which is mainly reflective of Mona's offering. So for me, I think that's like a true step up.
To me, it's getting to watch my friend grow and also witnessing changes in his life that are very personal on the level of my relationship, but are reflected in this very deep way in the music, which are probably lost on a lot of people listening to the record, because they'll hear whatever they want, and that's the point, obviously. But for me personally, I thought it was such a tremendous leap forward and such a bold new kind of take. It's still very much Drab Majesty, but it's a new entity within that.
Modern Mirror is the latest release from this duo. On the front cover, you can see a picture of Deb in his platinum blonde wig and face makeup that only adds to their mystique. Their style and the way that they present themselves is what appeals to a majority of their fan base. They are so unique and different from mainstream live music, and because of this, they are separated from the rest and truly drawn in a fan base from all over the world.
Like that's, I cannot stress enough how amazing it is to have a community of people who actually care about what you're doing. It's very rare. And so we are deeply, deeply indebted and appreciative of all of those people and all of those places that welcome us with open arms.
A big thanks to them for sitting down with me during their short time here in Minneapolis. I hope we hear some more wild adventures from them. Anyways, this has been Lizzie Ritchie, signing off.
That's all for this episode. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by Ben Hallam, Tosin Fasimo, and Lizzie Ritchie. I'm Nathan Fervoy, your host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.